We were fine before. Now we have all these scientists and... These guys, she said, nodding her head in Beckham and Horn's direction. A man with a hunched back walked over to Horn and Beckham. A woman with braided red hair stood by his side, one arm tucked through his to help him stand.
You all know something about that? She asked them.
The man in the chair wheeled over, readjusting his shotgun when he arrived alongside the other two.
You're new here, she said. You know what they brought in, don't you?
Ma'am, we're sheltering down here just like you, Horn said. Why don't you go sit down with your, entourage?
Don't try and dismiss me, she snapped. I've had enough of that. I want some damn answers.
And I'm telling you we don't have them, Horn said in a deeper voice.
Some of the people got up from their cots and chairs, forming a tight circle around Beckham and Horn. Those that remained sitting turned their attention on the group.
Great, Horn muttered.
Beckham considered telling a lie to get them off his back and make them relax, but these people weren't stupid. Plus, that would only come to bite him in the ass later. Better to be honest, but sparing in the details.
It's true. Beckham held out his hands in a placating gesture. A few variants were spotted far outside the outpost perimeter. We're just taking a precaution. But there's no sign of any immediate attacks.
Hushed voices broke out. A couple of loud curses, too. Javier, Jenny, and Tasha didn't seem disturbed by his raised voice or the news. Spark and Ginger moved closer to the gathering crowd, curiously. They were a welcome distraction to some of the spooked children that came to pet them.
I promise we're safe here, Beckham said.
The promise didn't seem to help the red-haired woman to relax. She shook her head and muttered something to the old man leaning against her for support.
We haven't had a beast set foot in this outpost for 8 years, said the veteran in the wheelchair.
He narrowed his eyes, looking between Beckham and Horn like he was studying them.
Seems awfully strange that you all show up and that happens now, doesn't it?
Beckham got the feeling the man was trying to place them in some memory.
These fine gentlemen are here to make sure the beasts don't get inside, said a voice in a refined Texas drawl.
Beckham turned to see Fisher entering the shelter with his two guards. The two soldiers standing guard parted to let them through.
If I were y'all, I'd be thanking these two war heroes. They're trying to keep you and their family safe, Fisher said as he approached. The reason everyone here is still alive is because of the sacrifices they made in the Great War.
This dude again, Horn whispered to Beckham.
Beckham nudged his friend discreetly to indicate he needed to be polite. Fisher took his cowboy hat off and exchanged a nod with Beckham and then Horn.
You can all go back to your seats, Fisher said. You're safe down here.
Everyone turned away, except the woman and the two older men.
Come on, Sally,
said the guy with the hunched back. Sally held her ground.
My father fought in the Great War, too, when he was 60 years old. He spent his golden years fighting the beasts and knows a thing or two about sacrifice.
Beckham gave the guy a once-over again. He didn't look a day younger than 80 with wrinkles, liver spots on his bald head, and thin, wispy hair. Maybe her math was off.
Honey, said the man. Please.
My father's name is Lieutenant Frank Rodman, she said. He has stage 3 bone cancer from the chemicals he was exposed to in the war, so maybe you should be thanking him.
The retired lieutenant waved a hand.
Sally, damn it.
And this is Sergeant Christian Brown, also a veteran of the Great War who broke his back and lost his family, Sally said, gesturing to the man in the wheelchair.
Brown took off his baseball cap, revealing a bald skull with scars across the top that looked to be from variant talons.
Nice to meet you, Beckham said to them in turn.
He reached out and shook the lieutenant's hand, then the sergeant's.
Sally, you're absolutely right. These men do deserve our thanks and respect, Beckham said. Without men like them, none of us would have been able to start our lives over after the war.
We should be thanking you,
Rodman said. He squinted at the fatigues Beckham and Horn both wore.
I thought I recognized you both. Sally, I'd like to introduce you to Captain Beckham and Master Sergeant Horn. True heroes.
Wait, you know them? Sally asked, skepticism clear in her voice when she looked at Brown.
Both men nodded. Sally pursed her lips, looking between Beckham and Horn. Then she frowned and said,
I'm sorry for coming off a little hot.
Skepticism isn't the worst thing we faced, Beckham said. You're just trying to look out for your friends and family. Trust me. I can understand that.
Horn just grumbled.
I don't mean to sound so standoffish, but I know the military brought something here, she said. It can't be a coincidence that the beasts showed up now.
Sally still didn't look like she was going to back down, and as much as Beckham respected that, he also couldn't spill classified intel just because she was someone willing to fight for it.
Ma'am, if you were in danger, I would tell you. I believe we're all safe down here, Beckham said. I wouldn't put my family in harm's way or yours.
Sally nodded, but didn't seem satisfied.
Let's leave these men and their families alone now, said Rodman.
Brown nodded and turned his wheelchair, returning to his spot along the wall.
All right, Dad, Sally said.
She turned back to Beckham, but then reached out to help her dad. Beckham also reached out to assist.
Sir, if I may, he said.
Frank nodded, and his daughter and Beckham helped get him back to his cot.
Thank you, Sally said.
Beckham nodded and returned to his family where Fisher was talking to Javier.
Your son was just telling me how he hopes to be a soldier or a scientist someday, Fisher said. I'm trying to convince him being an engineer, especially a petroleum engineer, isn't such a bad thing.
Good luck with that, Beckham said.
Fisher smiled, and Beckham smiled back.
Your wife is still in the lab, I take it? Fisher asked.
She is, Beckham replied.
When do we get to see Mom again? Javier asked.
Shouldn't be long now, Beckham said.
The dogs wiggled their way through the throng of civilians. Fisher crouched and petted Ginger.
Good-looking dogs, he said. I sure miss having one.
Beckham also bent down, tousling the fur behind Spark's ears. In a quiet voice, he said,
"Want to tell me why you came down here?"
"To tell you something I didn't earlier," Fisher said. "This room isn't exactly fit to talk candidly about certain subjects, though."
Beckham checked to make sure the kids weren't listening. Javier had gone back to tapping his foot, bored. The girls were talking to Horn.
"I'll be right back, okay?" Beckham said.
Horn frowned and mumbled something about being a babysitter.
Kate should be here in about half an hour, Beckham said. Why don't you guys get out some food?
Javier went to their bags and started digging in.
Thanks, buddy, Beckham said.
He left with Fisher and his guards before Javier could protest. The soldiers standing at the shelter door opened it to let them out. They walked up the basement stairs and into the chilly night. Smoke fingered away from chimneys across the outpost skyline. Becker pulled his collar up and looked to Fisher.
All right. So what is it? He asked.
There's something I want to tell you that I would regret too much if I didn't, Captain, Fisher replied. I was told to keep this quiet, but my conscience kicked in and my gut tells me you're someone that I can trust. In a world where even the crack of a branch might mean something's trying to kill you, that means a lot to me.
And?
Beckham looked at his watch. It was already 8 o'clock, and Kate was supposed to be meeting them any minute for her short break. Fisher looked around like he was making sure no one was listening. Tran and Chase moved outward to give them some space.
I think this place is compromised, he whispered. And I think Presley knows it, but won't admit it.
You mean there are collaborators here?
Fisher nodded.
We believe there are cells at virtually all outposts.
I'd be lying if I said I didn't suspect the same thing now, Beckham said. But I wanted to trust Presley that he had this place locked down.
He sure thinks he does, but General Cornelius warned me I needed to be cautious. He fears that the collaborators know far more about what we're up to than we could have ever predicted. We need to be vigilant.
Beckham cursed his decision to bring the children here. If there were collaborators here, then Manchester was a ticking time bomb, especially with the mastermind here.
Reed!
The sound of Kate's voice snapped Beckham from his thoughts.
He saw his wife jogging down the street with two soldier escorts.
"We'll talk more later," Beckham said to Fisher. Kate ran to meet Beckham.
"What are you doing outside? Where are the kids?" she asked.
"With Orne. Don't worry. I was just talking to..."
S.M. Fisher, he said, holding out a hand. "Dr. Lovato, I presume." "Oh. Pleased to meet you," she said, her gaze flitting to Beckham. "I've only got a few minutes. We're making headway, and I need to keep at it."
Beckham nodded and looked to Fisher. He had an almost wistful look in his eyes as he said, "Go be together with your family, Captain."
"Nice to meet you," Kate said. She gave Beckham a look that told him she knew something was up.
He surveyed the quiet outpost one more time, hoping he and Fisher were both wrong about the collaborators.
Chapter 20
Dohai stood beneath a line of trees inside the National Accelerator Laboratory campus. A full moon burned away some of the darkness enveloping the scattered buildings and trees. If he were alone, he would have no issues infiltrating a place like this. There was plenty of cover and shadows to conceal his search for the SDS equipment. But with Mendez and 10 wolfhounds following, sneaking was far more difficult. He held up a fist to halt the team. From their vantage in the trees, he surveyed a row of 4 warehouses lining a road. A large office building loomed on the opposite side of the street. Nearly a dozen SUVs and trucks were parked in a line along the curb. Mendez paused beside him, and the 10 wolfhounds took shelter between the tree trunks. Using his scope, Dohai glassed the vehicles. As he suspected, these didn't have rotted tires or rust tracing up the side panels. More telling of recent activity were the pair of Humvees at the end of the line. An M249 was mounted atop each, with ammo belts trailing inside.
"People with firepower like that aren't fucking around, amigo," Mendez said.
"Best we don't piss them off, then," Dohai said. "We're already sneaking around their backyard. That would piss me off."
Martin moved up next to them, fidgeting with the AK-47 necklace hanging from his neck. He pushed it back behind his armored vest.
"Think we should call this in?"
"What don't you understand about radio silence?" Mendez asked.
Martin shrugged. Dohai remained prone, considering everything he had seen so far. The people who used those vehicles couldn't be far. Normally he could tell if he was being watched. This felt different. It was like these people had disappeared in a hurry. Maybe the people had seen Ghost and the wolfhounds, then bailed, he thought. But why would they leave behind these vehicles?
"Martin, you wait here with the rest of your team," Dohai ordered. "Stay hidden, okay?"
"Yeah, I got it."
"Mendez, you're with me," Dohai whispered.
They peeled away, creeping around the north side of the warehouses through the underbrush. Dohai normally didn't like splitting up, but Martin was clueless. Leaving him behind was better than dragging him along. Dohai scanned the rooftops for contacts, expecting someone to pop up with an RPG or a machine gun. He used the cover of the vegetation until they made it past the 4th warehouse. That's when he heard it. Muffled footsteps and the clink of weapons. Someone was headed toward them. He motioned for Mendez to get down, and they dropped to the grass. Dohai kept his barrel just high enough to fire should they be spotted. 2 men in black fatigues walked through the woods at a hunch. They were no more than half a dozen yards from Dohai's position. Further north, Dohai spotted another pair. Then beyond them, another. Mendez tapped Dohai on the shoulder, then pointed toward snipers that had appeared in the windows of the office buildings rising above the trees across the street from the warehouses.
"What are we gonna do?"
Mendez whispered as they watched the mysterious soldiers continue onward. Dohai took out his radio.
"We should let Fitz know."
He opened a private channel.
"Ghost 1, this is Ghost 3. Do you read?"
No reply.
"Ghost 1, Ghost 3. Contact spotted."
Still nothing. An icy vein of anxiety wormed through Dohai.
"What's the matter?" Mendez asked in a low voice.
"Radio isn't going through."
Dohai tried to open a channel to Martin.
"Wolfhound 2, Ghost 3. Contact's headed your way.
Again, he got no response. These people had set up an ambush that, thankfully, Dohai had discovered. But they must have a warlock system operating, which made Team Ghost's comms broke Dick. The implications were nerve-wracking. Fitz, Rico, Ace, and all the others were out there, potentially headed straight into another ambush.
"What are we gonna do, Jefe?"
Mendez whispered. Dohai shook his head, unsure.
"Maybe we should just shoot our way out of this," Mendez suggested. "I can get a drop on those two, you get the other pair. That leaves just two more."
Dohai thought about it, but there were too many contacts to take on without suffering major casualties.
"I say we try making contact," he said. "If nothing else, we'll learn their intentions."
"How about contact with bullets, not words? We got the drop on them. Couple of clean shots and we got ourselves an escape path."
"And a gunfight. I want to avoid that. Follow me."
They stood quietly and snuck through the trees. Dohai was close enough to the first pair of contacts that he heard them breathing. With a hand signal, Dohai gestured for Mendez to take the one on the right. He would take the other. The men moved like jaguars through the forest toward their marks. Mendez slammed the butt of his rifle into the back of his target's head. The man fell unconscious instantly. Dohai took out his buck knife. He locked one hand around his target's mouth and pushed the blade against his throat. The man froze in Dohai's grips. Pulling him tightly against his body, Dohai took him back into the woods while Mendez dragged his guy. When they were safely out of view and away from the other patrols, Dohai loosened his grip around the man's neck.
"Listen good," Dohai said. "I'm Sergeant Yaz Dohai with Delta Force Team Ghost, and I'm not here to harm you. Nod if you understand."
His prisoner hesitated, then nodded.
"We're not here to hurt you. We're here for some old equipment in those warehouses," he said. "That's all we want. Nothing else."
The man didn't reply.
"I'm taking my hand away from your mouth, but if you scream, I'll trace this knife across your throat. Got it?"
Another nod. Dohai turned the guy around enough so he could see the fear in the man's eyes. He trusted that meant the prisoner wouldn't do anything stupid. Then he slowly removed his hand, but kept the blade pressed against his flesh.
"How many of you are there?" Dohai asked.
The man kept his lips tightly closed.
"Seriously, we don't want to hurt you," he repeated. "We want equipment, and that's it. If you help us, we're willing to pay."
The man snorted.
"Fuck you, and whatever you have to offer."
Mendez glanced over, but Dohai kept his gaze on the man.
"You abandoned us out here," he said. "My people have survived on our own, and we aren't giving you shit."
Dohai wanted to curse, but remained calm.
"Look, we'll give you whatever you want."
"We want to be left alone," the man snarled. "You're better off leaving and pretending you never set foot here."
Dohai kept the knife at the guy's throat, trying to figure out what to do.
"Who's in charge here?" Dohai asked.
"Maybe he'll."
Muzzle flashes suddenly lit up the night, and bullets plunged into the tree behind him, sending a shower of bark over his back. Mendez squeezed off a burst of return fire. The captive held Dohai's gaze, eyes burning with rage. Dohai knew if he took the knife away, the man would try to kill him. But he wasn't about to execute the guy in cold blood either. Instead, he gripped the man's neck with his free hand, taking him in a sleeper chokehold. The man soon fell unconscious. Dohai got up and set off with Mendez the way they had come. Rounds chipped at the bark and whistled by their retreat. Keeping low and running fast, they made it back to the wolfhounds unscathed. Martin stood suddenly, pointing his barrel at Dohai.
"Friendly," Dohai hissed.
"What the hell is happening?" Martin said, lowering his rifle. "Talking with those assholes didn't work," Mendez said.
"We need to fall back to the rally point," Dohai said.
"All the way back to the freeway?" Martin asked.
"Yes," Dohai said. "Now go."
Mendez still looked like he wanted to stand and fight, but Dohai knew very little about the enemy numbers. They already had entrenched positions in the buildings. The last thing he wanted to do was be flooded by a veritable army with a ground advantage and cut off from the rest of their team without radio contact. He led his team away from the trees around the warehouses, charging back toward the rally point.
They ran through areas that had taken them a couple hours to infiltrate when they'd been sneaking through. Now, Dohai didn't care about stealth, just about keeping the team alive. The only way to do that was retreat as fast as possible. A cacophony of curses and hollers rose behind them. Gunfire lanced into trees and lit up the darkness like fireflies. The group broke from the cover of the trees and dashed across an open field. Then they passed along a road that took them another half mile to the parking lots filled with vehicles, apartments, and other buildings they had first seen when approaching the laboratories. They finally made it to a street that would take them another 50 yards to the freeway. One of the wolfhounds went down and slid across the asphalt. Dohai stopped and went back to check the guy, but he was gone, his forehead destroyed by an exit wound. More rounds bit into the ground, and Dohai rolled away, keeping low behind a few cars parked along the street. On his feet again, he bolted for the highway, hoping Fitz and his team would be ready for them. Mendez and the others made it to the freeway and started across. They crossed the first few lanes, then dove over the concrete wall of the center median.
"Friendly," shouted a familiar voice on the other side.
"Fitz." The crack of gunfire continued. A second wolfhound dropped to his knees, clutching his throat.
"Find cover," Dohai yelled.
Half the team had made it across the center median and into the ditch where Fitz and Singh were waiting. Fitz's team provided covering fire, and Dohai used it to cross the road, keeping low as possible. Martin and the other half of the wolfhounds were still crossing the freeway. Muzzle flashes sparked from some of the vehicles in the parking lots and from the windows of the apartments and buildings adjacent to the freeway where a second group of hostiles had set up firing positions. The wolfhounds stuck on the road were in the middle of an open killing field. Dohai was right there with them, crouched next to Martin against the center median wall.
"Over here!" Martin yelled.
Another wolfhound made a run for their position but was cut down. Dohai moved out to help drag him, but rounds peppered the pavement around the man's body.
"Come on," Dohai said to Martin.
Dohai and Martin climbed over the center median just as a flurry of rounds slammed into the other side. He hit the ground. Ace was standing in a ditch in front of him.
"Run, Dohai," he shouted.
Martin ran for cover but tripped and went down.
"Shit," Dohai grumbled.
He hunched down and went back to help him up.
"Grenade!"
someone yelled. Dohai had just enough time to help Martin to his feet when a fiery blast threw chunks of hot asphalt into them. The concussive force sent him flying forward, and Martin tumbling into a ditch. Ears ringing, Dohai pushed himself up, engulfed by a cloud of dust. He and Martin scrambled into the ditch. One of the wolfhounds lay on the slope, chunks of shrapnel jutting from his face. Ace was sprawled at the bottom of the ditch, coughing. Blood streamed from his nostrils. Rico ran to the older operator, and he threw his arm around her shoulder, limping away. Martin turned and drained his magazine into the distance.
"Fuck you, assholes!" he shouted.
Dohai grabbed him and yanked him down. The rest of the team was retreating into the woods, helping the injured get away. Fitz remained there, waving.
"Let's move!" he shouted.
Dohai and Martin hurried after, but the wolfhounds were moving too fast, and he could hardly keep up. A body suddenly flung into the air up ahead, dangling by a rope. He screamed for help, but was silenced by a sniper's round to his chest. He spun, limp and dead.
"Watch out for the traps!" Dohai yelled.
Having fallen back to help Martin, he couldn't guide the group through the forest. Most of the wolfhounds started to slow, ducking low as the gunfire blasted into tree trunks, but most kept running. A scream rang out, fading as a pit swallowed the man. Dohai barreled ahead, surveying the place for traps as fast as he could, yelling at the wolfhounds to fall in line. The gunfire soon quieted, and Dohai looked back, expecting to see their ambushers flooding across the freeway. But instead, only a high-pitched chanting followed them. Screams, like victorious war cries. As the team faded back into the forest, terror filled Dohai to his very core. The enemy was more dangerous than the variants. They were organized, knew the terrain, and were well-armed. And they were standing in the way of the SDS equipment that could help prevent the entire Allied States from collapse. One way or another, Team Ghost would have to make it onto that campus again. Timothy sat on the bench inside his cell, rubbing his neck where Nick had implanted a chip under his skin. The tracking device, along with the collar around his neck, made it pretty much impossible for him to escape. That meant it would be even more difficult to bring this place down and kill the collaborators. From what he had seen over the past few days, he doubted even the president knew just how well prepared these people and the monsters were for war. He had to expose this place and these people. He couldn't do it alone. He needed help. Not from people like Beckham and Horn, though. They had abandoned him and let his dad die. What Timothy needed were people who were dependable and brave.
"Hey," mumbled a female voice.
Timothy got off the bench he was sitting on. He went to the bars of his holding cell. The woman who Nick had drugged earlier was standing on shaking legs and looking at him from the opposite cell.
"Hey," Timothy said back. "What's your name?"
"Lily,"
she said.
Her sickly pallor was set off by a face that looked like it had once been pretty before the collaborators had gotten here. He feared that was why they'd kept her prisoner. A frightening thought wormed through his mind. He wondered what the collaborators would do with Tasha if they'd captured her like they had this poor woman.
"Why are you here?" he asked.
She looked down the hall but didn't respond.
"How long have you been in there?"
he tried. She looked at the ground and then shook her head.
"You don't know?"
he asked.
"No. Only that it's been a very long time."
Timothy figured that meant at least a few months.
"You have to help me get out of here,"
she said. Now he said nothing. This wasn't part of his plan. Her dark eyes pleaded for help.
"I can't live another day like this."
She seemed sincere, but he didn't want to blow his cover, didn't want to reveal his false allegiance to the collaborators. This could be another test from Pete, Nick, and Alfred.
"I can't," Timothy said.
He sat down again and looked away.
"I'm sorry." "Please,"
she begged, gripping the bars.
"They do awful things. They use me, like..."
Timothy swallowed hard as he listened. Everything that he suspected in the back of his mind was true. But he knew conspiring with her would get them both killed and ruin any chance of carrying out his plan of bringing down the entire organization. That was the only way to truly help her. Until this place was discovered and shut down, her nightmares wouldn't end. He focused on coming up with his next steps as the poor woman sobbed. Pete said Timothy was going to get them into Outpost Portland. Again, he would have to watch, listen, and learn once he was out there. Then maybe he would find an opportunity to fight back or escape. First, he needed to figure out where this base was located. Then he could tell someone when he was in Portland. A growling voice snapped him from his thoughts.
"Shut up!" yelled a guard.
The man marched between the cells and hit the bars of Lily's cell with a baseball bat. She jumped away and then hurried back to her bed, where she squeezed her legs against her chest and hid behind her knees.
"Stupid bitch," growled the man. "You're too damn loud."
Timothy wanted to say something. No, he wanted to take a knife and stick it in the man's neck. But instead, he just sat there, biding his time, listening to the helpless woman whimper. It was one of the hardest things he'd ever had to do. The only thing holding him back from yelling at the guard was his thirst for revenge. Finally, the guard retreated to the other room. An hour or so later, the door to the brig opened, and more footsteps echoed. Pete was the first man Timothy saw. Nick and Alfred followed, all three dressed in fatigues, armored vests and duty belts with holstered pistols, sheathed knives, and extra magazines. They stopped outside his cell.
"You ready to prove yourself?" Pete asked.
"Yeah, it's about fucking time," Timothy said.
Pete nodded to Alfred, who unlocked the cell.
"Come on," Nick said.
Timothy stepped out and followed the men away from the cells. Lily gazed up and locked eyes with him, but he didn't give her anything. Not a wink, or a friendly smile, or a nod. Nothing but pity. Pete took them down a wing of the bunker Timothy hadn't seen before.
Most of the paint had flecked away on the walls that were now covered in grime. Two more men waited at the end of the next corridor, armed with M16 rifles and dressed in fatigues. It took both men to pull open the steel door at the end. Beyond the door, a mezzanine stretched across a chamber illuminated by lights built into the walls of another silo. Nick went first, his boots clicking on the metal surface. Alfred and Pete escorted Timothy next. He froze in his tracks halfway across, his eyes locked on something below that couldn't possibly be real. "Move it, fuckhead," said one of the guards behind him. Timothy felt the cold touch of a gun barrel prodding his back, but he didn't move. Even in the dim lighting, there was no mistaking the massive missile below the walkway. Nick twisted back to face him with a wry grin.
"What?" he asked. "Never seen a ballistic missile before?" "The government lied about a lot of things before the war," Nick said. "The world thought the only nuclear missile silos were in North Dakota and Wyoming."
The butt of a gun slammed Timothy in the back, forcing him forward. He followed Nick to another steel door that the group opened to a narrow metal stairwell. His mind spun with questions each step up. Did the missile work? Were there more? Was this part of their plan? The implications nearly took his breath, but he kept his composure. None of that mattered if he screwed up now, and this gave him even more reason to find a way to expose this place. Alfred opened the door at the top of the stairs, letting in moonlight. This was the first Timothy had seen in days. He waited for his eyes to adjust to the darkness until he could make out a field of knee-high weeds rustling in the cold wind. The men set off across the clearing toward warehouse-style buildings tucked away in a wooded area. Timothy covertly studied his surroundings, trying to identify the location, but he didn't recognize this place and had no idea where they might be. "Eyes ahead," said a guard. He gave Timothy the butt of his rifle again. Timothy winced. Heat rose to his face, but he couldn't let himself lose control now.
"You don't like that, do you?" the man said.
He rammed the rifle butt into Timothy's back again. This time Timothy couldn't help it. He turned and glared, teeth gritted.
"You better fucking look forward, or I'm gonna break your face," the man growled. "Keep walking, and don't do anything stupid," Alfred said.
Timothy hesitated just long enough to memorize the man's face. He was going on the list of collaborators he would kill first. They continued until they got to the warehouses. A tall canopy of trees, some still with their leaves, protected the buildings from a bird's-eye view. Camo tarps also helped disguise vehicles and equipment outside. The double doors to the first warehouse were wide open, revealing another small fleet of vehicles. Pickups, mostly, but a few military-style trucks and a Humvee. There was also a black muscle car. The collaborators Timothy had seen in the briefing were working inside. Others had joined them. All wore fatigues and body armor with slung rifles and holsters on their hips. The only man not armed was another guy wearing a collar like Timothy's. He was on both knees next to a pickup truck, his gaze on the floor. Timothy was brought over to him and instructed to sit. The collaborators loaded gear and weapons into their vehicles over the next hour. By the time they had finished, ominous storm clouds rolled over the sky, masking the stars and moon. The first clap of thunder sounded, rattling the metal walls of the warehouse.
"All right, listen up," Pete said.
The collaborators clustered around him.
"We're headed back to Outpost Portland to finish the job," Pete said. "We've softened their defenses, and now our job is to blow holes through what they have left so the beasts can get in."
Several hollers broke out.
"Burn it to the fucking ground," one of the men said.
"The heretics deserve to die," said another.
Pete raised his hand, and the space quieted.
"Once Portland is gone, we will all be rewarded with a visit from our master," Pete said. "No more mistakes. Our time is almost here, and once this is complete, we will be headed into the final reckoning."
The men's features transformed from excitement to fear, shadows playing over them with each distant strike of lightning.
"This has been a long time coming," Pete said. "Years of planning have led to this,
And we're not the only ones. All across the land of the new gods, our brothers and sisters are rising up.
The hollers and hoots came again, their voices rivaling the rolling thunder. Pete motioned for Nick, who walked over to a side door. He opened it and stepped back. Guttural barking sounded outside. A man wearing what looked like a riot suit entered, holding a chain and a club with barbed wire wrapped around the shaft. The slack in the chain straightened out, rattling from whatever it was attached to. The guard yanked on it, and in came a muscular beast with a maw covered by a muzzle. It was another freak dog like the one Timothy had seen earlier, only this one had a collar around its neck. The creature growled, spine going rigid and hairs spiked like arrow quivers. Saliva dripped out of the muzzle onto the ground.
"It's time to unleash our new weapons," Pete said.
A second guard in riot gear followed the beast into the room. Muffled barks escaped from the muzzle until the man clicked on a remote, zapping the dog into submission. Several more genetically modified canines were brought in and loaded into cages in the backs of pickup trucks.
"Mount up," Nick called out. "We move out soon."
The men fanned out into vehicles while Nick walked over to Timothy.
"You, my pimple-faced friend, are going to help us get inside the command post," he said.
The man who had hit Timothy with his gun barrel withdrew a black bag and pulled it over Timothy's face. A hand grabbed him and pushed him into a truck. Motors growled to life. Over the noise came the barking of the dogs in the back of the pickup trucks. They sounded nothing like Ginger and Spark, even when the dogs were angry. These canines were starving, anxious to feast on flesh. Timothy's stomach curdled with the thought of just whose flesh they would be dining on tonight. Chapter 21. Beckham had done exactly what Fisher had expected any hard-headed Delta Force operator would. He had marched to the forward command post to discuss security again with Colonel Presley. This time, Master Sergeant Parker Horn accompanied him too. Fisher had joined the meeting, but kept his mouth shut. His men were holding security outside a tent functioning as their command point outside the area where Presley had his desk and war tables. Beckham was determined to root out the issue immediately as soon as Fisher told him about Cornelius's worries that collaborators had infiltrated Manchester.
"Captain, I understand your concern, but we do not have a collaborator problem," Presley said. "The problem we're facing right now isn't some boogeymen hiding in our base. The problem is finding those packs of juveniles we spotted before. Their trail disappeared an hour ago, and we need to pick it back up, not waste our time throwing around crazy allegations."
Presley was trying his best to hide his frustration, and Fisher didn't want to add fuel to the fire, but he had no choice.
"Colonel, I regret not bringing this up earlier," Fisher said. "But it seems too much of a coincidence that the juvenile scouts showed up right when work began on the mastermind. Now, I'm not a military man, but I've been around long enough to run into my fair share of company spies looking for the next oil or mineral rights to pull a land grab right under my nose."
"This place isn't an oil field," Presley snapped.
"No, it's not. But I'm telling you that my experience and recent events sure get the gears in my head turning."
Fisher gestured toward Beckham.
"When I mentioned this to Captain Beckham, he insisted we come back to you, because we both respect what you've done at this outpost."
Presley clenched his jaw. He set the folder he was holding down on a table and motioned for Horn to shut the tent flaps.
"What I'm about to tell you doesn't leave this tent," Presley said.
"Understood," Beckham said.
Fisher and Horn nodded in turn.
"A little over a year ago, we discovered a group of terrorists planning to poison our water treatment plant," he said. "They were collaborators, but we never found out much more than that."
"Poison with what?" Beckham asked.
"A poison isn't exactly the accurate word."
Presley hesitated, apparently considering his words carefully.
"They were planning on infecting the water with VX-99.
"What?" Beckham said.
Fisher was equally surprised to hear this. Horn's brow creased, nostrils flaring like a bull ready to charge.
"Why wasn't President Ringgold informed of this?" Beckham asked.
"I informed the proper people," Presley said. The president is the proper person, sir,
Horn growled. Fisher had to admit he agreed.
It seems to me the administration of this country has the right to know about terrorist activity involving VX-99.
Look, I've taken care of my people here.
Presley shook his head.
We don't need any local problems blown out of proportion. If you think back 2 months ago even, before those attacks, local economies relied on trade between all the outposts. Who wants to trade with an outpost that has a collaborator problem?
The president had a right to know, Beckham repeated. And I had a right to protect my people, both from physical and economic harm.
How can you be sure you've actually protected them?
Since those arrests and the following executions, we have not had any problems.
Presley shrugged. Burning people alive in the town square has proved to be a good deterrent. I'm a big believer in making my actions count more than my words. Any potential collaborators knew from then on we meant business, and I made a promise that if we caught more, I would do worse to them than the variants would.
You never found out who they were working with?
Horn asked.
No. None of them would talk, Presley replied. We used every technique we could and got absolutely nothing from the bastards.
Beckham and Horn exchanged a quick glance. If the juveniles know the mastermind is here, it's not because anyone within our walls leaked that intel, Presley said in an argumentative voice. You might want to take your search for collaborators elsewhere.
I don't buy it, Beckham said. I still have more questions.
Presley let out a grunt.
Captain, your concern is noted, but we need to find those juveniles.
I agree, but they might not be the biggest threat, and I need to ask a few more questions, sir.
Presley looked exasperated, but gave Beckham a nod.
How many people have gone missing from Outpost Manchester in the past few years? Beckham asked.
I'm not sure, Captain. We don't exactly keep a running census.
Fisher found himself wondering the same thing Beckham probably was thinking. How could the colonel not know?
You don't have any idea. Not even a range, Beckham asked.
It's a low number, I know that. Less than 30. I would have to check with my staff for a better total.
Presley was agitated. He walked around the table and called over one of his officers. Then he turned back to Beckham.
You gonna tell me why this information is important? He asked.
It's important because collaborators use people by kidnapping their family members and forcing them into serving the variants, Beckham said. Or other times, they simply brainwash them. Think Stockholm Syndrome, on steroids.
Happened at our outpost,
Horn grumbled.
I'd recommend putting together a list and checking with the family members of the people still living here, Beckham said. That's one way to see if there's anyone who might be connected.
A female officer opened a tent flap and saluted. Presley spoke to the woman quietly, but suddenly went rigid after she said something in response.
Son of a bitch, he said.
He went outside and continued talking with the woman in trenchant voices for minutes.
That doesn't seem good, Fisher said.
The tent flaps opened again, and Presley walked over to a table with maps draped across the surface. He pulled out a pen and circled a spot.
We lost a scout a few minutes ago, Presley said, but we know where the juveniles are.
Fisher surveyed the location. It was to the east, not even 5 miles from the outpost perimeter. Presley looked up from the map.
I recommend getting back to your shelters and hunkering down for the night. Captain, for your benefit, I also charged a team to start looking into what we discussed.
Thank you, Colonel, Beckham said.
Presley sighed.
I hope you're wrong.
Me too, Beckham said.
Fisher followed him and Horn out of the tent. They cradled their rifles as they walked into the street to join Tran and Chase.
Any update on that monstrosity your wife is working on? Fisher asked.
She didn't say much, Beckham said.
Better get back to the kids, Horn said. I don't trust that redhead lady we left them with.
We better try and snag some sleep, Tran said. No way I can sleep with everything going on.
Chase spat onto the ground. I'd go for a beer instead.
I wouldn't say no to one,
Horn said with a chuckle.
We can drink when we win this war, boys, Fisher said.
Agreed, Beckham said. Until then, I'm staying frosty. The group set off down the empty streets, quiet with the curfew imposed by Presley. When Beckham and Horn got back to their building, they parted ways and headed for the shelter. Fisher continued down the road with his men, walking for close to an hour. They were almost back when the sound of diesel engines rumbled through the night. A convoy of MATVs cruised through the empty streets, stopping at the shelter Fisher had been assigned. Men in riot gear jumped out of the vehicles and rushed inside. Fisher moved aside with both Tran and Chase getting in front of him when more soldiers hurried over, shouting for their IDs.
"What the hell are you idiots doing out after curfew?"
a guard asked.
"Take it easy," Chase said. "We were just talking to the colonel."
"No need to go Gestapo on us," Tran said.
"Shut the fuck up and show me your ID."
"Now," said one of the guards. Fisher understood the value of intimidation, but these guys were pissing him off. He and his men hadn't done anything to deserve this kind of treatment. When he got his ID back, shouting came from the front entrance. The men in riot gear pulled people out, their panicked voices filling the otherwise quiet night.
"Where are you taking me?" one of the men said.
"We didn't do anything," shouted the woman.
Fisher had expected to hear the shrieks of monsters tonight, but he didn't expect to hear the cries of terrified people at the hands of the base's own guards. He didn't exactly regret going to the colonel about collaborators, but now that he'd seen the results, he worried paranoia and rumors would add a dangerous, unforeseen threat to Outpost Manchester's existence. "Get inside," said the guard, standing by them.
"Calm down, bro."
The guard grabbed him and shoved him hard. Tran stepped between the two.
"Don't you fucking put another hand on him."
Fisher found his hand inching toward his holstered .357. Another voice rang out.
"What the fuck is going on here?"
An officer walked over, a vest full of magazines and a helmet over his black face mask.
"These men were out during curfew," said the soldier who had pushed Chase.
Chase stood next to Tran now, both tense and ready to fight.
"We had a meeting with Colonel Presley, you dumb shit," Fisher said.
The officer motioned for the soldier to return to the truck. After he left, the officer said,
"Get back inside the shelter. It's not safe out here."
Fisher glared at the officer but said nothing. Instead, he motioned for his men to move inside. Once they were through the door, the guards locked it, leaving them only a window's view to the street. The officer got back into an MATV, and the armored vehicles pulled away, speeding to the next location.
"I was about to break that dude's face," Chase said.
"Me too," Tran said.
Fisher watched the vehicles round the corner.
"What do we do now?" Tran asked.
"We wait, and we pray I'm wrong about the collaborators," Fisher said.
"And if I'm not, we get ready to fight."
"Our test today is the most important yet," Kate said. "If we're successful, we can actually figure out what in God's name the variants are planning." The mastermind let out a long exhale that rushed over Kate like a storm-borne wind, carrying with it the rotten stench of a garbage dump. The two giant muscular limbs trembled, and its eyelids fluttered. Nothing Kate had studied during graduate school had prepared her for a test subject like this. In fact, she couldn't imagine anyone in the massive laboratory at Outpost Manchester had ever thought they would be experimenting on a giant monster that wanted nothing more than to have them all killed. She turned from the half-sleeping beast and joined Sammy, Sean, and Carr at a nearby laboratory workstation. On it lay the bioreactor with a chunk of pulsating red tissue inside of its clear plastic drum-like container. One of the mastermind's tendrils was attached through a port via microelectric array. On the other end of the tissue, another array connected to Sammy's computer. Sean looked between the computer and the beast, his right foot tapping the ground. His fingers traced across the regulator for the monster's sedative IV drip.
"Are you sure we have to keep that thing half awake?"
Kate appreciated Sean's concern, but his wariness was holding back their research. It almost seemed like he was purposely trying to slow things down, but they were all tired, and she wasn't working as quickly as normal. Sammy responded as she typed at her keyboard.
"If we put it to sleep, then I'm just talking to a comatose blob.
The thing didn't respond last time until we woke it up with enough prodding. And we're not going to make any progress if we don't get an actual response from the beast, Kate said.
We won't be doing ourselves any favors if we're scared to confront the mastermind.
Carr leaned over the bioreactor chamber, scrutinizing the tissue within. Nodding, Kate pointed at Sammy's computer. The technician had done a great job adapting the collaborator's software so they could translate an input signal. That should help them intercept any communications in the variant network once they hooked up their own computer systems to the webbing.
We can't just be reactive anymore. We have to be proactive. The way to do that is to send our own signals through the network, Carr said. Signals that can interfere with variant collaborator communications, or even lure them into a trap.
First things first, Sammy cut in. What kind of messages do we want to send it now?
Maybe we should try to trick the monster into thinking it's tapped into the actual variant network, Kate said. That might get it to open up more, and give us a chance to test how well our messages pass for the real thing.
Why don't we just tap into the real webbing network? Sean asked. We can circumvent the mastermind. Wouldn't that be safer and quicker?
Sammy laughed, swiveling in her seat.
No way. Not at all. Look, we're trying to play biological hackers here. If we don't know what we're doing, and we send a message that makes it obvious it's coming from the outpost, then the variants will rain hell on us. But if we can fool the mastermind, then maybe we can use what we learn to trick the rest of the variant network.
Exactly, Kate said. So long as we're only connecting the mastermind to this secured bioreactor, it's like we're operating a computer at home with no internet access. But as soon as we connect to the internet, or in our case, the variant network, then any beast or collaborator could connect right back to us.
Not a good idea.
The mastermind shifted in its restraints. A long growl escaped its bulbous lips. Kate eyed it suspiciously, waiting to see if it would make another move. But it settled back down, its head rolling on its shoulders.
I really don't like this.
Sean tapped on a gauge, measuring the sedatives pumping in through one of the massive IV lines into the mastermind.
It's unpredictable. We're playing with fire, just guessing how much we think it needs.
I trust you'll keep the beast under control, but if all else fails, you have my permission to knock it out, Kate said.
Sean kneaded his fingers together nervously, taking a step back from the lab bench.
Just focus on taking care of the lab equipment and connections to the mastermind, Kate said.
Sure, Sean replied. Truthfully, Kate didn't feel safe either. Not with a monster that could destroy her entire team with a single swipe of its scythe-like claws. Even the dozen soldiers along the walls of the massive lab didn't make her feel much better. She couldn't help but think of Javier and Horn's girls, in addition to all the other people sheltering at this outpost. If the abomination escaped and started attacking from within, she worried how many would fall before they could stop it. But worries like that wouldn't solve the challenge they face now.
Sammy, reopen the connection with the mastermind, Kate ordered.
A few keystrokes and numbers scrolled across the computer monitor. The mastermind's tendrils squirmed like long red snakes slithering from its body. All around the laboratory, Kate watched technicians and scientists stop what they were doing to watch the giant.
Connection confirmed, Sammy said. Ready to proceed on your mark, doctors.
The monster's tendrils undulated as Sammy performed some basic checks. She input simple commands checking the status of the mastermind.
Alive, she typed out.
The response came back, yes.
Where?
Location unknown.
Identify yourself.
Bionode 22.
From their work with the mastermind, they had determined that the masterminds called themselves Bionodes, though they were still unsure who had given them that name.
Network connection with other Bionodes? Sammy probed.
Unavailable.
In its half-sedated state, the monster continued to respond robotically. None of the dramatic anger filtered into its responses. For that, Kate was optimistic. It meant Sean had to have dialed down the sedatives at just the right level. But for the next part, they needed a stronger response from the beast.
Sean, reduce the sedatives, Kate said.
We need the mastermind in a higher state of consciousness.
Sean's fingers shook as he adjusted the regulators on the IV lines. The mastermind's eyes blinked, and its arms started to lift, yanking on the thick chains attached to the iron scaffolding. Simple inquiries like the ones Sammy had tried so far were easy. But if they were going to disrupt the variant collaborator communications, if they were going to send bad intel to compromise the enemy's strategies, then they would need to create significantly more complex messages that would fool even the mastermind. Now was the moment they had been waiting for. The final test that would determine if they had figured out how to do just that. To accomplish it, Kate had to rely on Sammy's computer genius to translate regular language through the collaborator's software into signals that the mastermind could understand and react to.
"Let's put your work to the test," Kate said. "Ready, Sammy?"
"Ready," she replied.
"I want to see if the mastermind will listen to our commands. Tell it to stand."
Sammy's fingers worked across the keyboard. For a second, nothing happened. Then the monster began to push itself up, eyes still roving back and forth like it was drunk. It managed to stand, wavering as it did.
"Damn, I didn't think it would actually listen," Sammy said.
"Tell it to walk forward," Kate said. Sammy typed in the command, and the monster shivered, huge saucer eyes pulsating, searching around the chamber. Saliva dripped from its toothy maw.
"I think I let the sedatives off too much," Sean said, beginning to twist the regulator.
"Hold on." Kate put up a hand to stay him. The mastermind took a stumbling step forward. Its eyelids peeled back a little more, and its lips shook into a snarl as it continued to walk forward until the slack in the chains started to disappear, straining against the scaffolds. With a snarl, the beast reared back one of its claws. Messages scrolled across Sammy's computer screen. "Where am I? What's going on? Enemies everywhere. Where is Master? What does he command?" But this time, Kate didn't signal for Sean to knock the creature out.
"Sammy, tell it to stand down. Tell it we are the Master."
The beast pulled against its restraints. Chains clinked together, and dust fell from the ceiling. Iron groaned, echoing around the cavernous room. Sammy's fingers worked across the keyboard. With a final lurch, the beast stopped and stood, relaxing its limbs.
"Master," came the message back on the screen.
"Yes," Sammy typed back.
"Sit down."
The beast dropped immediately, a long sigh coming from its flared nostrils. A tremor rocked through the laboratory.
"See?" Sammy asked, looking at Sean. "We got this under control."
Kate nodded.
"Good work. What else should we tell it?"
The team began a more complicated conversation with the mastermind, asking about the number of variants back where they had extracted it in New Orleans, and how many other masterminds were out there. It knew pitiful little intel. It was more of a tool than a real mind at all. Sammy let out an exasperated sigh.
"I guess we can think of this bio-node thing as more of a Wi-Fi router that merely transmits and receives complicated signals. It's not like a hard drive that contains and stores a bunch of data."
While they couldn't drag out more useful intel from the monster, they had at least managed to fool the mastermind into thinking they were on its side. That was good news for weaponizing their technology, Kate thought.
"We should be able to load this software onto other computers," Carr said.
"Then we can install the same language processing applications on other computers."
"This is our Rosetta Stone," Kate said excitedly.
"Wherever Ringgold's armies go, they can hook those computers up to the variant network to monitor and disrupt communications." The other scientists and engineers around them nodded in agreement, looking pleased with their victory. But Kate noticed one who was not.
"Sammy, what's wrong?" Kate asked. "Is something not working?"
"No, it's all working. Quite well, in fact."
"That's the problem."
"I don't follow," Carr said.
"Think about it."
Sammy nodded toward the mastermind.
"Someone or something not only created creatures like this one, but they perfected the webbing network and a neurobiological interface to go along with it," she said. "All in a matter of years. That person, this master that the beast mentioned, must be more intelligent and powerful than these beasts.
There's another mastermind, Cade said. Realization seized all sense of accomplishment.
Sammy nodded.
That's who we have to find and destroy for this nightmare to end.
Chapter 22. Daylight glowed over the pine trees, casting their shadows across the makeshift camp. Dohai and Mendez were out searching the area, but Fitz, Ace, and Rico were seated around the tree trunks. Dirt covered their fatigues, and deep bruises underscored their eyes, evidence of the lack of sleep they all suffered from. But exhaustion was the most innocuous thing they had to endure. Fitz stood, his blades creaking. Rico followed. They walked past a couple of men with bloody bandages. A few wolfhounds secured the perimeter, their rifles probing the shadows among the woods. Singh was leaning against a tree with a canteen in his hands, head bowed, either in prayer or asleep.
"Lieutenant," Fitz said.
He looked up and cleared his throat.
"Master Sergeant," Singh replied.
"Do we have a final head count?"
"Two dead, another six injured, and three missing."
Fitz gritted his teeth together, imagining what had happened to the three who were missing. Neither of the men needed to think too hard about their fate, assuming they'd fallen into those crazy people's hands. These demented, sick people devoured variants in some ironic twist of fate, and if they did that, they would savor the flesh of a normal man. Singh tugged at his beard, gazing up at the blue sky between the tree branches, as if he was looking for an aircraft to come rescue them.
"How long are we going to sit here?" Singh asked. "It can't be safe." "I've got Dohai off making sure we're not being tracked," Fitz said. "He's also looking for any injured that may have been lost during our retreat."
"We'll know if someone's coming," Rico said, joining them.
"Your man basically walked into a trap before. What makes you think he will?"
Singh let his words trail. But he was right. Dohai had seen this coming too late.
If he had failed, that meant these men were damn good. "We stay here and stay frosty," Fitz said. "We won't make the same mistake again."
"What about calling in reinforcements?" Singh asked.
Rico let out a wry chuckle.
"Reinforcements? What reinforcements? Hate to break it to you, LT, but we're on the other side of the country. We're it. This is on us now."
"Afraid that's true," Fitz said. "When we left for this mission, our defenses around the outposts were already